Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Going back to The Onion, I think the majority of us would argue that the attribution is not that great anyways. You can, I mean, we've seen malware families and stuff like that that make it look like they come from a certain country, and probably not.
Are you saying these can be faked?
I'm saying that I want to make attribution dice that we can just roll, and whatever country comes up, that's okay. We're going
to
blame them.
And then I have to say, does it matter? Does it matter where it came from? I know it's great to be able to point fingers away from your own, but at what point
does
it
matter?
Just not worth the time.
Does it matter? Does it matter who actually did it? Probably not. But I think from the perspective of how we like to track techniques, and it goes back to understanding the adversary, right? So from that perspective, we do care because now we're forward looking. All right, what's next? What should we expect?
But Eric, would you say though that the cost of doing that though is much higher? Meaning when companies, just say enterprises, have some type of an incident or breach and insurance gets involved and IR gets involved, that process is strictly to get them remediated or back to a production. It's not necessarily to say, hey, now that we did it, we're going to dig even further, because they're going to ask that question. Do you want us to tell you where it came from and who was involved? And if you said yes, and they said, well, that's going to cost you another $200,000. You guys are like, well, no, let's just get back to making parts. Let's just get back to
this. This is where the value of the law enforcement relationship becomes really valuable and important. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've been seeing way, way, way amazing things coming out of CISA and out of the FBI, and the building of that relationship for organizations that hadn't done it before or were hesitant. Please, this is a time to go relook at that, because then you do that handoff and you don't pay the Google Mandiants or the other, you know, other firms to do that for you. And you say, you give it to CISA, you give it to the FBI, and let them look at it at a more macro level. And then they can correlate that at a nation state level, because at that point, it likely is something nation-y.
Right. And for many of us now, I mean, that handoff is going to be non-negotiable. It's forced, right? With some of the legislation that's coming out.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You've got what's going on with the SEC. There's another one that's going through. Did it just make it through the House?
And I think it made it through the Senate. It hasn't made it through the House yet. Yeah.
So there's a lot ramping up on that. It's going to get interesting. I've been reading through the SEC guidance and all of that, and it's going to change the way we do things. I mean, a lot of the tenets for the big companies, and Earl Doobie actually had a good talk on this. It was a question that came up at FutureCon and was kind of talking about how for big companies, it's not that big of a deal, right? We're doing a lot of those components that we can make those disclosures. We can talk about our programs, but it may be a little painful for some of those smaller companies that are going to have to start ramping up, starting to explain the security programs they have in place. It's crazy right now.
Yeah, and that's funny, because that was a parallel to what they were talking about in when GDPR came into play, that it was actually in order to enter into a field, you had to be this tall, you had to do this amount of work. And it actually, the fear was that it would end up stifling local innovation because you couldn't afford to get started. I think it's been somewhere between that, you know, that doomsday scenario and zero that it's actually been. But I do know it is harder to get started. And if you layer some more of this on, now keep in mind, I'm not saying we don't do it. Yes, I think it's exactly the right idea. But doing it means that it's going to be harder to get for people to get started.
I think we just have to be careful in how we go about it. And we have to fully acknowledge the complexities that are at play. I mean, go back to what Brian's walking through and all the everything around currencies and all of that. I mean, the world continues to get much more complex than it was, and especially in our field. because I know you go back, it wasn't too long ago that they were proposing and holding CISOs personally liable for some of the things that could happen.
Well, that just happened.
With which company?
The courts just cleared.
Is this in regards to SolarWinds?
SolarWinds. Thank you. Yes.
That's what came out. Okay.
So the courts just, I think that they threw away, they threw out a motion to keep the CEO, the CISO from being directly liable in class action. I mean, it's a pretty stark, guess what? You're on the hook. Coming out of the U.S. courts, this is just in the last two, three weeks, and a great reminder. If you haven't, if you are in one of those roles, or you happen to be doing insurance planning, make sure you can start covering this stuff in your D&O insurance. But make sure that this is that your CISO and that your CEO and that your board are included in for this purpose in your directors and officers insurance.
It's amazing. I mean, just kind of puts it in perspective. I was thinking about this the other day that, as a security community, what we've done within each of our programs, within organizations, we've come so far from where we once were on the security front, but yet in comparison to other areas within the business, we are still so young and still so figuring things out. I mean, if you go back to just the financials, right? You know, GAAP reporting and all of that, that's structured. It's highly structured. This is how you do it. And there's so many rules around it, and we're still trying to figure all of that out.
So one thing I wanted to touch on, though, when you were saying that, and I think, Dan, you commented on this, was there was this fear that if you started to put too much around the process and security controls and all this other stuff, that the cost to entry would stifle innovation, right? And that you can't do that. So now you instill fear back into the government that we got to keep pace with the rest of the world, right? We got to make sure that, in this, not going to the destabilization of the US dollar, because that's a much long-winded conversation, but we need to make sure that we're still number one at speed and everything else. If you look at any industry, including automotive, including even construction, anytime that there's been any type of legislation or scare around, well, we need to make sure we put this in place. Well, no. That's going to make the cost of building a home that much more expensive. The level of entry for people, we're going to be removing a certain, you know, entire class of people, and they won't be able to afford homes. That wasn't necessarily the case, right? It was building better quality, safer homes, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Putting rules in place. Same thing in automotive. When people started talking about, first it was seatbelts, then it was airbags, and that the cost of putting all these safety systems in there, right, is people aren't going to be able to afford the car anymore, right? But when you look at the overall volume, I think it goes right back to Intel when he said he was going to sell the silicon transistor, right, for a dollar, right? It that everyone's like, there's no way, you could never sell it for that. They were used to making those fat margins. But if you're putting one inside every single product that's produced, the volume,
you make it up, right? On the volume sheer,
so I where I'm going back to is that software right now has a high amount of volume. And Dan, I know I was having this conversation about agile and poking the bear there earlier, right? But was originally predicated on the fact of how to speed up development software to get it out there faster. All the controls weren't built into it. It was, how do we do this fast and how do we get it out there? Now we've become loving the idea of fast, right? It's like when I was just this morning picking up donuts for the kids and looking at the line inside, and I could see people frustrated. They're not used to having to wait 5 minutes for their donut. This is ridiculous. Donuts, I walk in and I get them now. 5 minutes? Ridiculous, right? But what if the quality of the donut went down? Would you still come back, or would you go next door, right? Like, is the quality of the software there, right? Or are we predicated on pushing things out so fast, right, that we worry about secure and vulnerabilities or good produced software later, right? And let the companies figure it out. And that all falls back onto security at some point. There's not a morning I don't wake up that I don't read about some new zero day or vulnerability in some type of software that's out there.
But let's translate this out into the physical realm. America is and has very much been about low cost for a long time. Low cost. Walmart is what Walmart is, because low cost, driving low costs. And that has come from certain actions, certain steps, certain efficiencies along the way, but it has set all of that has set the idea of low cost being the benchmark for success. Looking at gas prices, we're at $4 a gallon on average across the country now. And that is apparently this rippling death blow to the idea of low cost in America. Like, this is something that political futures will die as a result of having changed low cost gas. And I mean, I understand it's how people get to work. It's how it's how people's livelihoods happen. But we're so focused on low cost of everything, the race to the bottom, that quality, and you got to take your head out of this, out of the manufacturing, out of the automotive realm. Quality has never been able to stay when price was on the line. Look, to go at the broader level, quality, look at where feel the shirt you're wearing. I promise you, yeah, it is not the same quality as the shirt you wore 20 years ago.
Dan, 100%. This goes back to Takata, Nissan, et cetera. Every time there has been a major issue and they go back and investigate, it's, well, we got rid of doing these quality checks, got rid of doing this because in terms of trying to hit price targets, we needed to reduce costs. And there's only so much you can pull out in material and process. It was like, well, why do we have to do 20 different quality checks? Why do we have to do this? Well, we're adhering to this internal policy we created to meet a target from the customer. Okay, why don't we change that from 10 checks per shift to one, right? Well, now you don't even have any data to show that you were really doing it because you really weren't doing it. Right. So then when you actually have a major problem and someone dies and it's like, show us the data. And it's like, well, we quit doing it.
We're built as a low cost society. Go ahead.
We are. And that, I think that really highlights the danger of what metrics that you're chasing. I mean, you go back, and I think we've mentioned on here before, go back to Wells Fargo, yep, right? Look what happened with them. They incentivized their employees to start opening fake accounts for people. Why? Because they were tracking, the incentives were all around how many products can I sell on a per person basis? Well, if that's your incentive, now granted, where does it, take it a level deeper? Where did that tie back to? The street. It was the market, right? And where'd the market come from? Think about the shift in economics that with Friedman, that what are we beholden to? Shareholders. So what do we do for shareholders? We're maximizing value. So what happens? We thin out supply chains, that we're going for the low cost. This is what it generates. This is the problem.
You put unrealistic targets in place, and those are predicated on, if you don't meet them, what does mean? Well, maybe you don't have a job. And when you do that, what are you doing? You're instilling fear. And when you put fear in someone, it leads to what? Self-preservation. When you put self-preservation in place, it's like, oh, okay, I got to meet the number for him. Opening up a fake account, is that so bad? I'm doing what they asked me to do while preserving my job, right? Protecting myself, not everybody else around me. I'm protecting. And you see that in going back to all the examples, Dan, I was giving around, why do you stop doing all the different quality checks? Well, those weren't necessarily requirements. We put those in place to try to meet a target from the customer. But if we reduce all that stuff, we save money. We understand that there's going to be risk involved. But we're doing it because I got to hit a number. I got to hit certain number of parts out the door.
But now let's, right? And, but now let's bring it back into the security realm and look back at some of the original, what are some of the original security incidents that people talk about? Home Depot. And you and a few others, and you look at long-term trends in market value, and every single one of them has recovered, and not just recovered, but grown as a result of it.
Right.
So now there is definitely, now take that same quality checks, is it as important, which is now again why we're seeing the law come around and force some of this stuff. Is it important that we do it ourselves? No, because you know what? We'll take a small dip. We'll pay the price. And you know what? At the end of the day, we're still going to end up growing. And that is why this is that whole idea of self-regulation. You try it, it doesn't work. And now this is why we're seeing the same thing happen in, why we're seeing the FTC start to step in, the SEC start to step in, and the US Congress start to step in to ensure that the right pieces are put in place, just like the NTSB. Just like, you know, we now have this on the security side. Same thing exists in privacy, and why Americans are generally pitching for an effective national privacy law. It hasn't been working, because if you don't give the bounds, they're going to keep going because the market will drive it. We have the opportunity. We don't have rails. We're going to keep going wide.
Eric, would you agree though, like an audit team or a risk management team that you have though, they're not just in place to come in and find a bunch of things wrong and wave a flag and say, look what we did. We found all these problems. Those are the same type of teams that work on the assembly line. And yes, I am going back to automotive, that go through and help find the gaps that cause quality problems and then work with the manufacturing team to figure out how do we implement, whether it's pokey oaks, changes, et cetera, that aren't going to increase the cost of the assembly line another $1 million with the same output, because then you're never going to have a return on investment. But help figure out, well, maybe we change the process slightly rather than add all these new checks to the process, change the process to put in better quality or better security or better risk management, right? It's not about coming in and pumping the chest, right? It's coming into work as a team. And that's where, I mean, relating it back, risk management, audit, et cetera, part of quality control, part of process control, part of all of that.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a critical partnership. And that's why kind of I look at our internal audit team as one of our greatest partners and being able to get things done and making change. I mean, essentially, if you look at it, they're process pen testers, right? That's kind of what they are. They're looking at your process, trying to find those gaps and sampling to make sure that you're actually doing what you say you're doing. And if it's the right move and if it caps the risk to the right tolerances within the organization, certainly a critical, but it could be dangerous, right? I mean, in the context, as we're talking about, you know, margins and maximizing revenue and all of that, that it could quickly become kind of a perfunctory exercise. And I just wanted to use the word perfunctory this morning, so now that I've got that out there, that it just becomes kind of check the box. But I, you know, from my perspective, I think some of this will shift from a market standpoint. As you look at the dynamics of younger individuals coming up that look at investments differently, they are not just looking at it from the perspective of just pure returns. You know, as we look at, you know, DEI coming in, ESG, all of the different terms there that are coming in, looking at the different way, looking at organizations, not just from a revenue stream, but what else? What is the greater good that they're doing? So I think there is some opportunity there. We may see some shift that may fix some of these underlying problems on what we've done and focusing just on shareholder returns.
Dan, take this kind of peeling back, totally agree with you, Eric. But now let's take this back to, okay, when there are incidents, breaches, et cetera, so your audit group is never going to be able to put a finger on, well, where did this, you know, threat actor come from, right? It's looking, they're looking at your own internal processes, what software you have in place or products you have in place and the right number of people. But taking this back to where the conversation started, Dan, when we're actually looking to pin who did it and why they did it, which is important, an important context to understand where we're going in the future, right? Or what the reasoning was behind, and we always want to know, well, what the reason was. And maybe sometimes there isn't a reason, but usually there is. The level of new laws, new requirements, and everything that's coming out that'll help drive some of that. If you go into the last 15 years, though, last 20 years, and when we were talking about the differences between China and Russia, you know, what China was doing from a cyber warfare standpoint versus what Russia was doing, or maybe not Russia itself, but what Russia was allowing to be done was more disruptive. Do you think there'll be, based on the rules and regulations that are coming out, the way the US government's looking at it, that there is going to be an even bigger focus on the why, who and the why?
The way things are coming out now, I think it's the what and the what and the how much. I don't think the why or the why not again, the CAPA portion of it, the corrective action, preventive action, I don't think that's part of it. I think it's just, you need to stop holding it to yourself and get it out in the world so people can know that their stuff's been affected. That's been the focus of everything I've seen to date, because it's all about breach timelines. It's all about effective notification, even before you know something. You know, we saw this again with Okta just in the past few weeks. Oh, you know what? We saw something, we didn't tell anybody. We didn't know if it was a thing, but we didn't tell anybody until we were called out on it. That kind of annoys me because you knew something was there, and you know, it became a, you know, I don't like to criticize other, you know, other security professionals, but I think this is a great example for all of us to say, let's err on the side of the person who's affected and get that out. And that's where the laws are. That's where the laws here are heading. They're not focused on the why. Now, some of the turn it over so that the big guns can go and look at the how. Turn over the data to CISA, right. Turn over the data to the federal government so that they can look at it at a macro level. I think that is a great thing, but they're not looking at companies to do that, nor do I see any indication that they're going to tie it back yet to the company that was affected and say, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? I guess unless it passes a level of negligence or a level of consistency. But I don't see in those laws anything for, you know, if three strikes and you get yourself a federal lawsuit.
Yeah.
I don't know. Eric, I was going to say, I don't know that there would be, but Eric, I'm going to turn this over to you then. I think there's a good reason why the government can't do that. But on the same side, if they did, what's the why? And companies were disclosing that, oh, yep, our latest C3 Hercules, all the information on the plane, the engines and everything else was stolen. So they'll be able to build it for one third of the cost that we did. Oh my God. Shareholder value stock would plummet overnight. Just the fact that you were breached. Yeah. It goes down and it comes right back up. And you've seen that happen. Target, name the company, right? Little dip, little up. But if it actually stole proprietary data, something that you've actually set expectations to the street on that 3 years from now, you're going to deliver something that's new and innovative. And you told everyone, well, they just basically stole all the source code to it and everything else. No, the market's going to react. Shareholders are going to react. That's a big deal. But if people knew that, other companies would be like, oh my God, we need to do something different. Oh my gosh. Eric, sorry, go ahead.
Well, and that's why, actually, I mean, if you read through the SEC and what they're putting forth, that's why I actually think, and I'm kind of interested on your thoughts here, Dan. I think the term that we've typically, so it's materiality is really what's ingrained in through all of that. And we've always talked about that in the terms of Sarbanes-Oxley and what is actual material to shareholders. But I feel like that's about to shift. And exactly what you're talking about, Brian, that usually it's been a dollar value. What's the dollar impact to the organization? But now reading through some of those comments, it starts to take, it's not all quantifiable, it's qualitative as well. Thinking about that intellectual property that today, you really, it might be harder to put a dollar value around it. But now as you look 3 years down the road, if somebody else can get to market and now I don't have a market for what we're going to be selling, that there is a material aspect to that. So I think that definition is going to start expanding on what we need to report in. And it calls out in there on the theft of intellectual property, that if that gets stolen, that's now a reportable offense. But there's other things in there that was interesting, because I think there was a comment about denial of service or the threat to release information. And I almost see that as akin to, you know, without getting in too much into politics on what's being proposed on taxing certain individuals on income that's not really recognized yet, right? That if we look at the market value of certain investments that are still investments. They haven't actually been pulled out, so nothing to recognize, but they want to tax it on that. I think some of that is starting to creep into cyber, that a threat was made against you, that data might be released. Therefore, that is an event now that is disclosable. It's interesting. I totally going back here.
The denial of service that will come when they start pestering everybody, when the bad guys start pestering everybody, and saying, we know something about you, and then you have to report it. I mean, there's the pendulum. Anything you use can be used to an extreme to keep you from doing anything.
Right. And we got to be careful with some of that too, because who knows, how are you telling if somebody's truthful? I could go to any company right now and say, hey, I've got your information, pay me.
And you have to, but we also have an obligation to, you know, to investigate all of it.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I was thinking about it. So I have to somewhat disagree with Eric of 20 minutes ago as we were talking about attribution. And I was thinking about this. You know what? It is going to be super important for companies in the terms of insurance, right? Because attribution is really what you're going to, Was it an act of war or was it an attack against you? Because those will determine payouts. If you don't have correct attribution, I may not get money back for that event. And that becomes a huge deal. But at the same time, and I feel like I'm kind of that stepping up on a soapbox here.
Actually have the ability to help determine that and are not just at the whim of your insurance provider.
Well, I mean, looking at it from the practitioner standpoint, do you really want to be beholden to the insurance provider to tell you if it was an act of war or not? Or is there going to have to be some neutral third party that's telling?
And is the neutral third party then the IR companies? And then how do you ensure that the IR... this is where I'm going with it, because
the IR companies that are mostly paid for by the insurance companies.
Interesting, yeah. Because you look at the medical industry, I love
the work that IR companies do, but the money is coming by and large through the insurance pipeline.
So when you look at all the insurance fraud that occurred in the medical industry over the last 20, 30 years and fake claims and everything else, or not just, I won't call them fake claims, but somebody gets injured and it's like, well, did you know though, that if you weren't able to work for the next 3 months and you walked around with this limp, that you would get paid X amount of money, right? It's like, yeah, but it was only a sprained ankle. Yeah, but, right? And I'm really throwing a curveball here. But if you look then at the company, right, just experienced X issue and it's, hey, if somebody's advising you that, well, if it was this, you get paid X, but if it was this, you get paid Y.
Yeah, but Larry Johnson, when he sprains his ankle, doesn't have to disclose to the court of public opinion and Wall Street that it happened. So Larry Johnson can do it until he gets found out. There are other controls in place in corporate America, especially in public companies, to make those public, make them reviewed. But who's
doing the investigation? And who are they getting paid?
It doesn't necessarily mean there's always investigation. I think so. Now let's go to scholarly research. I'm going to take it out of your court and put it into mine. Let's talk about this in terms of academic research, bio research. There have been in the National Science Foundation, which funds a significant portion of scientific grants in the U.S. And now, as of early next year, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, that fund the vast majority of the rest of scientific research grants are going to require that all data sets for funded for research funded by them will be made public, so that all of your data, so others can decide to go and look at your research. Others can decide to go and look at this. I love the idea of making these publicly available. So now it's not necessarily that you have to get an investigator, because anytime you are forced to do something, you now then have a path towards shaping it. Look at where SOC 2 has gone. Look at where 27001 has gone. They're great in fundamentals. And if you want to play the game, if you want to do it because it's the right thing to do, you can. But there are also approaches that aren't quite so legitimate. Now, if we put the data out there in the specter, now let's take this to people now have the ability to look at it at their discretion. If there's an interesting topic, you can put 50 people looking at it from different ways and they can come up with different things. Now, unfortunately, we've also wandered into the realm of mercenary vulnerability disclosures and, you know, the hacker brands that are capitalizing on researchers that want to be paid to see their, you know, for vulnerabilities. I mean, I think there's the idea that there is public accessibility to the output and therefore could be scrutiny of it is another interesting approach that doesn't take a single paid path that can be gamed, just like certifications. As soon as there was a path, there was the useful path, and then it became gamed. Just like SOC 2 and others, there's the path and then it becomes gamed. I think the idea of making it publicly visible for anyone to see and potentially scrutinize and feedback to the world, I think is a really good balance, a check and balance. Now, of course, those people can hold you hostage when they find something. They can go, hey, you pay us or we don't tell. It's just another approach, taking one based on research imperatives, but also encourages you to do all that you can write up front and then make it public so others can take a look.
But yeah. Research is searching for the why. So Eric, if you get hit with ransomware, right? And your company looks at it and says, oh my gosh, it might be cheaper just to pay the ransom than the 3 weeks it would get to get back up online. But your IR company says, well, whoa, we got to be careful here. This could be one of the sanctioned ransomware gangs. And by doing so, you would pay a fine. And they immediately look at it and say, guess what? The code that they use, we can immediately tell you right now that although it looks like it, we can tell you today that this is not them. And until the US government figures out that it is, if we pay it right away, you're not going to get hit with any fines and you can be back up and running in 2 days.
Right.
Oh, so now you're being advised by the same company that's supposed to be doing A, the investigation, the remediation, that it would be cheaper to pay, helps the insurance company out as well, than it would be to do the full remediation because it comes down to money, comes down to shareholder value. And that if we push this right away, we can do so because while we know it's probably them, they changed up their code the way it was used. And this one is not in the little bucket of sanctions that the US government can classify. So you pay it right away. And in the end, a month later, when the research does come out and shows that it was, okay, just add it to the sanction list. But you got around it. You circumvented it. Because in the end of the day, it comes back to money, how fast we can get up and going, everything else. And that's why I was going with the why part.
Right. And that highlights the variability in that whole realm right now. And I think it gets back to the importance of bringing in law enforcement early on so that you've got that coverage that, hey, it was vetted at the time. This was the decision that was made. As long as you can show a trail of why you made the decision and why it was the right decision at the time, you should be all right. But you know what I still struggle with is we still vilify the companies that get hit. Mm-hmm. Now, there are instances where there is negligence. I get that. But I put this in the context of a physical war. This would be like shaming Ukraine that, oh, look what you did. You let Russia just walk right in there. Like, and that's the physical. Nobody would ever make that comment, right? The same thing like a bank. I know we've used that analogy before, but shame on the bank for allowing somebody to come in with a gun and rob the bank.
I debate that though. I disagree. Let's go. I think we have come as a society to shame those that don't act appropriately afterward. I think we are getting more and more. When I see fingers wagging right now in this, it's to people who didn't disclose, who weren't transparent, who didn't take due care once they knew about it. Not necessarily that they had the incident at all. I think the idea of incidents, the idea of it's not if, it's when, is starting to sink in. Now, amongst our own cast of security characters, we do have commentary about things that people could have done better and we learn from it. And I think that's an important part of calling out what went right and what went wrong, that we all can collectively learn and not make the same mistakes, which also requires transparency, which is also equally hard for many companies to do. But I think it is not about the fact that something happened as much as it was 10 years ago at Home Depot. It was about Home Depot messed up. Now it's about, hey, Okta had a thing where they messed up. They didn't tell anybody.
But I agree with Eric here, though. It is vilifying, Dan, because as soon as the headlines hit that Toyota was breached, Toyota wasn't breached, right? Toyota has a breach. I mean, in 2 minutes, I was able to read three articles that clearly showed that there was a supplier that was hit that caused disruption to Toyota's
but
process.
That is about but clicks the number, and is the same thing. But
it's the media vilifying, right? And the people then fall. The number of people that texted me, right? Just because they knew where I worked prior to coming over, like, hey, did you see Toyota got hit? And I was like, oh, like, guys, that's a domino effect of supply chain. It was the same thing when they said LinkedIn got breached. Somebody went and scraped a bunch of personal data that's available out on the web and then put it all together to say they had millions of terabytes of data. And you saw the same thing on CVS, a fake site where somebody goes in and clicks and enters their information, right? CVS themselves wasn't hit. There's so many different examples. And until somebody publicly comes out to explain it to everybody, you'd have to shut down like every news outlet out there where they get up and you got people that should know better getting up and saying, well, you know, with the latest breach of Toyota or the latest, you know, cybersecurity incident impacting Toyota, just the way they want to word it.
But that's not limited to just this. I think this is, you know, Bob kicked a kid. Bob kicked a picture of a kid and it looked like a kid. You know what? So let's report on it. We'll figure it out. We'll fix it later. This is not just something that we have. This is a way bigger problem, and I don't think we can fix it just in our own field.
I think we got to be careful though to delineate the viewpoints on the public's perception and our perception as practitioners. I think our perception as practitioners, we start to scrutinize companies and looking at their response, right? That we acknowledge that everybody's going to get hit. But in the court of public opinion, look at the number of times Congress pulls companies in front of them and we're going to have this big meeting. How could this happen? Let's all get on soapboxes and have this conversation. No, because we vilify companies. Now, again, there are cases where there is gross negligence. I get that. Then let's talk about those issues where corners were cut, that we were more worried about the money on the street and showing revenue. So we cut corners and therefore we took on more risk than we should have. And this resulted in this result. But by and large, I think those are not the norm. The norm is companies that are doing the right thing, that are putting the practices in place, but still get hit because of the complexities of systems at play. It's not like protecting a house, right? And I kind of preach into the choir here. It's not like, well, I just got to lock my front door and then we're good, right? There's millions of doors throughout the organization. And not only doors, you know, if you think about it in the context of firewalls and stuff like that, at the end of the day, it's people. It's people running mm-hmm. things. And people are easily targeted and there's ways to get around it. And let's be honest, as practitioners, we have to be focused on meetings, compliance. We have to do all these different lists of things, but the attackers don't.
Nope.
They have one goal. All they have to do is find creative ways to get in. And we need to be careful about how we scrutinize companies when it is truly stacked against us.
Oh, it absolutely is, which is why I guess I have started to feel like it's not quite that more and more, even in the general public, are understanding that it happens now. And, you know, despite the race for ratings and the race for clicks that is out there in this world for other, you know, similar business driving media, they have markets to try and appease too. But I think that, you know, the more we continue on and demonstrate that, well, I guess one, the more it continues to happen to others, to everybody, the more that picture becomes clear. Not that I'm looking for everybody to get attacked and compromised, but I think that it's, we're on a path toward more having had it than not. And then just taking the path of, I lost my thought.
No, I was gonna say you could keep going there. I was loving the fact that our debate turned into like a really live debate there, right? Like, I mean, there was some serious energy.
As opposed to our other pre-recorded staged ones.
No. Eric, going back to say, well, I want to go back and change what I just said 20 minutes ago, because now I want to come at it from this angle. Absolutely. And for most people that are listening in, this is 100% always live debate, which is great. Like the back and forth, we normally begin with a 10-minute discussion, right? So I'm excited, and for the listeners that we have, I'm really excited for what's coming up. I'll let Dan talk about it, but we have a live recording in front of a great audience for MCWT, and we're probably not going to have that 10 minutes where we get to figure out how we're going to lead into it. So it'll be really interesting.
We also have seated catalysts in the audience helping fuel some of the debate. So yeah, as Brian said, we're going on the road. We are actually doing a live external session. We did one for Sim Detroit that was over Zoom, but we're going to go in person May 5th, 2022. In Novi, Michigan. If you happen to be there and happen to know of the Michigan Council of Women in Technology, MCWT, this is their Executive Connection Summit. I'll put a link in the show notes to take, but if you're in the area or happen to be in the area or want to be in the area, May 5th, 9 to 2, we're on near the end of the day, but it's a great day of information and sharing across not just security, technology, security, leadership, and more. Please come out, and we'll be recording a live episode that the current plan is to also make it available here, but we can't guarantee that, because you never know with technology. So sign up and come on out and see it live and be in the audience and give us hard topics to debate in the real time. But we're really excited to get to do this and thankful and grateful to MCWT, the Michigan Council of Women in Technology, for asking us to join them for this. And then next week,
and we
also have,
I was just going to go there as well. Go ahead. I was just going to mention that, Jess.
Yeah, and next week we have a returning guest. We've only had one outside. We've only let one other party into the podcast, and she's coming back. Jess Byrne. Apparently, we didn't scare her enough last time. She's coming back in our next episode. It'll be episode 39 to talk about the annual. The annual recommendations for your security program from Forrester. It's a piece of research that she authors along, I think, with Jeff Pollard and others around Forrester. And she's going to bring some of those program recommendations, and I'm sure we'll find a way to debate some of them.
No, that's exciting.
This is going to be fun.
Yeah, especially I'm looking forward to one being able to take it on the road and do something live in front of everybody else. Because I think it will help them see that the pre-recording, there's not a ton of editing, at least, Dan, I hope not, to once we get going, right? Unless
I'll just edit out the word not a ton. There is a ton. I'll just edit that out so it's more accurate.
in the number of times I have to clear my throat and then tell Dan, can we go ahead and pause and come back to it, does happen. But I'm hoping to get in a bunch of it depends. Live in front of everybody else, which should be nice.
Is that our goal? We'll have tally marks to see who can use it depends the most times.
We'll be in Novi. We won't be too close to the casinos, but I'm sure we could set up a bookmaking for how many it depends they will be.
Is it true that Buffalo Wild Wings, you can already gamble from Buffalo Wild Wings via MGM?
Gambling as in, do I eat the hot sauce or the blazing and take that gamble?
No. They were supposed to like set up like some style of a sports book within Buffalo Wild Wings so you could wager on games while you were there and watch the games while you eat. Now, this is something that I read about like a year and a half ago, right? And never looked back into, because so you can see how much I actually really gamble. I take risk management extremely serious. Right.
I'll only gamble if I can gamble on the chance that they'll bring back the third W. Buffalo Wild Wings used to be called BW3, and it was Weck, which is a type of bread, and they had beef that they'd slice on Weck with this pump with the caraway seeds on top. And I truly miss that third W. So I'll place the wager on the odds. Unfortunately, it'll be a very small wager on a very large return, because it's likely not coming back.
And this is where people need to watch the video, because you can see Dan was building the sandwich with his hands, right? He's like, you know, it's sliced, stacked up. It's a beautiful piece of Weck.
Yeah. Now this will be fun. It'll be interesting doing it live. And that's, you know, for anybody listening, when we jump into the conversation and Dan mentions that you are now joining the conversation already in progress, that is true to form. Yeah. That's literally how this works. So I'm thinking at MCWT, what we need is 10 minutes. They can just turn the audio off. We'll just sit in the corner and start the conversation. And then when they're ready, they can just pivot to us so that we're already mid conversation.
There you go.
Sounds good. I really like that a lot.
Sounds good. Well, and I think with that, we're going to close for today. Again, I'll put links to the MCWT registration in the show notes, and all of the things we've talked about today will be in the show notes as well, including a link to BW3 and their sports book, and if they have it. We look forward to seeing you again soon. But in the meantime, we really want your feedback. You can email us feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or find us on Twitter @securitydebate. We also make this available in both audio and video form. If you're listening to this on audio, go to YouTube, type in the word Great Security Debate. Watch me build that sandwich with my hands. I assure you, it's extra delicious looking. And if you're on YouTube now, you can go to your favorite podcast application and just search for Great Security Debate and subscribe there. We really appreciate you being a listener and being a viewer. We really enjoy doing this, and we like knowing that you're out there. So let us know that you're out there. Send us a mail, send us a tweet, send us some sort of feedback. Find us on LinkedIn. We're there too. But we'd love to hear from you, not just about feedback, but about topics you'd like to hear coming soon. And to you, Brian, and to you, Eric, thank you so much for being here. We always have a great time, and today is no different. In this case, I think the debate's going to continue long after I hit the stop recording button. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you again soon on the next Great Security Debate.